Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin in a moment and speak with George Lakoff. Backed by popular demand, George Lakoff is a linguist at Berkeley, and he made an interesting presentation a couple of weeks ago where he analyzed what motivates the conservative movement and why blue-collar people vote Republican, you know, in apparently against their interests. So we'll be talking to George Lakoff. We'll talk with Michael Mann, the author of Incoherent Empire, and Michael's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and his major works include the prize-winning series The Sources of Social Power and The Rise of Classes and Nation-States, and he's presently working on a third volume, Globalizations, which covers the most recent period of world history. We'll talk later with Mark Green, who, along with Eric Alterman, has written a book, The Book on Bush, and How George W. Misleads America. Do we have George Lakoff? George, you with me?
I am indeed.
How are you, George? It was good to see you the other day at UCLA.
It was a pleasure.
And it's pretty clear that this is a government that represents capital and not people. And I can't believe how much people are out in the cold, and how increasingly so. And as this becomes two Americas, I know that's the theme of Edwards and his campaign, but we clearly are heading towards two Americas. And essentially getting rid of the middle class. And a country without a middle class is a country on the way out. So why is it that the middle class in this country don't recognize that they're an endangered species?
Well, that assumes that the right way to divide up the country is by class, and I think that's wrong.
Well, who's dividing it? I mean, it's the way it happens, isn't it?
Well, it's one division, but I think that the important political division is a very different one. I think it has to do with worldview, and there's a very, very good reason why poor conservatives vote for George Bush, even though it's against their self-interest. The reason is that Bush represents their moral worldview, and they identify with him culturally, and that's what people vote on. They vote their identity and their values, not necessarily their self-interest.
Now, why is it that America is alone amongst the Western democracies that they don't vote for politicians who actually do something for them? I mean, the fundamental nature of the rest of the democracies are you vote for politicians who provide you with health care, with child care, with pregnancy leave, etc. You know, you pay your taxes, you get your services. What happened to that equation?
Well, there was a certain Margaret Thatcher in England where that wasn't true for a long time.
Right.
Okay, it's not just America that works this way.
Well, at least they had it before she started to undo it. I mean, here we don't have it. I mean,
well, look,
we talk about it, but...
What's important for progressives to understand is that there are two very, very different moral worldviews out there in the world. And especially in this country, and that we're in the middle of a cultural war. The moral worldview that is being pressed on us is not just the worldview of wealthy people. There are plenty of wealthy people on the left. You know, the moral worldview is one that has an authoritarian government behind it, and that says that this is a good and important thing. Moreover, it says that people need to be disciplined, that the disciplined people are the good people. They're the people who can follow rules, do what's right, not wrong. Also, discipline is what makes you able to take care of yourself, to earn your way in the world, to pursue your self-interest, which is assumed to be the right thing to do, to become self-reliant. And the people who can't are the losers, and they should be the losers, because morality and prosperity go together. So that poor people, when told, hey, all the tax cuts are going to the top 1%, will say, well, you know, maybe they deserve it if they have that worldview. And this is something that's, you know, very, very important. It's not just about economics. It's about politics in general. It's about the war. It's about the issue of same-sex marriage that's coming up now. It's about views on education. It's about every single issue. The country is divided on every issue. And there are, you know, a lot of people out there who have a worldview that you and I don't share.
Well, but whether or not you share the worldview, it's the nature of the way these divisions happen that is so sterile and pointless. I mean, the abortion debate is completely sterile. You know, the ecology debate, it's either you're either for a spotted owl or for jobs for sawmills. I mean, in terms of alternative energy for automobiles, you're either a road warrior or an eco warrior.
That is, again, if you talk to someone on the other side, you'll get a very different argument. You know, and it's very important to understand exactly what the conservatives believe and why they believe it. You know, I'm not defending them. I think that they're wrong morally, but you know, you have to understand them because you won't be able to defeat them unless you do.
Well, they're not exactly easy to defeat because they've got all the money. They've got the media. I mean,
that's not true. It's not true that they have all the money. There's plenty of money on the progressive side. It's just not used very productively.
Right. And let's get into that a little bit, George Lakoff, because I understand. From my time I spent in Washington, it seemed that there were all these public interest groups that are on the progressive side. None of them, whether they're for the environment or against militarism or for human rights and other issues, they never spoke to each other. They jealously guarded their fundraising list. And, you know, the left always talks about solidarity, but it doesn't practice it. There's this kind of balkanization that...
That's correct. There's a balkanization. And it comes about for an interesting and horrible structural reason. On the right, the right-wing foundations give money to right-wing think tanks. The think tanks are extraordinarily powerful and wealthy, and they are what are controlling the debate in this country. And when they're given money, they're given large block grants to do what they need to do. The reason for this is that the moral system on the right says that the highest value is preserving and defending and extending that moral system itself. But on the left, the highest moral value is helping individuals who need help. And so foundations on the left say spread the money around, organizations should not overlap, they should not spend any money on talent development, on career development, on intellectuals, on communication, and that they shouldn't waste a dime, they should parcel it out. And so what you get is a division imposed by the funding agencies and imposed by funders that say divide everything up into minor issue areas, issue by issue. And this is what happens in the organizations on the left. You get advocacy groups, policy institutes that go policy by policy, and you don't get an overall vision. Whereas the right has developed an overall vision through its think tanks over 30 to 40 years. Yes, they've spent $2 billion on it, but it's not like the left doesn't have money to spend on it. The left just spends its money in other ways.
There are a handful of billionaires like Richard Mellon Scaife who fund these think tanks and give the seed money. Is that what we need? Do we need a left-wing Richard Mellon Scaife?
Well, we need, you know, a dozen of them. And but there are plenty of left-wing billionaires. That's not the issue. The issue is how they spend their money, in part. Whether they're spending their money on sort of shaping the debate in the country and understanding their ideas more clearly, developing the ideas that they need, rather than simply sort of being charity, giving money to charity. Mm. What's happened is that every time budgets get cut, the left-wing foundations feel they have to take over more and more of what the government ought to be doing. And so the right winds up privatizing the left.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that we seem to be heading in a curious way in the 21st century. We seem to be going back to the 19th century, the Gilded Age, in terms of the concentration of wealth. And back then, when William Jennings Bryan was running against McKinley, it seemed to me that and maybe I'm getting my history wrong, George Lakoff, but it seemed to me that back then there was this kind of populist movement both amongst industrial workers and farmers throughout the land. You know, Jennings Bryan also was extremely much a fundamentalist preacher. You know, he was he argued for creationism in the Scopes trial. There's no question that the religious right is a powerful component of the Republican Party, and many argue that they've taken over the Republican Party. Why is religion reposed on the right, or at least they've usurped it? Why is it that it apparently used to be on the left? I mean, remember, you know, the prophet Jesus was a revolutionary at any rate.
There's a very good reason for that. First of all, there's no such thing as a single ideological basis for a religion. They're all multiple. And the right-wing Christians have what I call a strict father morality, which is what is the basis of right-wing politics. They have an interpretation of Christianity that's very, very different than that of progressive Christians. Now, there are many, many more progressive Christians in the country than there are right-wing Christians. But if you talk to progressive Christians about their ideology, they're not clear about it. They don't know how to understand what their religious theology is and how it relates to their politics. They can't really express very well what is it that they believe about their religion that differentiates them from the right-wing Christians, and they can't link it up to their politics. But they're there, and they need to learn to be articulate about that, and only then can they become organized, because the right-wing Christians are thoroughly organized, and it's that organization that gives them power.
Plus, they've invested in radio and television networks. They've got a tremendous infrastructure and they basically have, in the name of religion, essentially created a front for right-wing politics.
But they've done it for a reason. And it is, you know, what their priorities are. You know, they've understood their priorities, and then they've gone and followed them. And people on the left have not seen this danger. They didn't see it coming.
Mm. Well, how does it work? I asked Ron Suskin this question because we do have a president that's hidden from view. When you pry loose, there's this book of Ron Suskin's, thanks to the information that the former Secretary of Treasury gave him, you get a sense of a very dysfunctional White House with a president with little intellectual curiosity and apparently very little knowledge, a very ideologically driven White House, and that's why they're getting in trouble, I think, in foreign policy, because ideology and reality don't necessarily mesh. What is it going to take? Is it the nature of politics that it is kind of Pavlovian, that it only gets better when it gets worse, that these people have to make a royal mess of things before they're exposed?
If only that were true. It's not.
well, give me the bad news.
Things can get much, much, much worse. What's involved is that you do have an ideologically driven government because you have an ideologically driven populace. You know, the people voted for them. And more...
Well, not enough of them voted in the first round, that's for sure.
That may be, but they still voted for them. They got out the vote,
right,
and they voted for them. And that's something that you have to remember. Now, the folks who voted for them have what I call a strict father morality. But everybody has both versions, the nurturant morality that I've talked about in moral politics and the strict father one. And the question is, which dominates your politics? Which is more active? And right now we have a situation where the country is divided on this. Mm. The question is how to make your view of the world more active. And that requires an understanding of how to frame the debate. They know how to frame the debate through language. They have a language apparatus, creating language and testing it constantly, teaching people how to talk about these things, and teaching people not only how to talk but how to think and reason from their point of view. Progressives have no apparatus like this at all, except the nascent one that we're trying to form, the Rockridge Institute here up in the East Bay, where we're putting together people from the University of California at Berkeley and Davis, not at the universities, but in a private institute, to try to do very quickly for the left what the right has done over 30 or 40 years.
So when you talk about the moral father figure on the right, I guess that explains why women tend to vote. Apparently Bush is doing very poorly with women and doing well with men.
The gender gap does follow those lines, but it's more complicated than that.
Well, again, I'm talking with George Lakoff, and I think, George, this is some of the most important stuff because, you know, I spend a lot of time just sort of talking about whatever's going on in the news and trying to find out from the smartest people I can find on the phone, anywhere, wherever the story's breaking, what the best insight is. But, you know, you rarely get into the mechanics of politics and political thought, and that's where I think you're doing us all an enormous favor.
Well, you know, right now, the biggest issue around is same-sex marriage, and there's not very much interesting or good discussion on it that's sufficient. I think there's a lot to be said here, and I think some of the best discussion is going on in San Francisco, where Gavin Newsom, the mayor, is actually he's issuing marriage licenses and challenging the state, the constitutionality of the state law. I think this is an important thing, and the state's Democrats, I think, don't understand how to stand up for it.
I think they're running scared. They think the polls indicate that the reason the White House has chosen this non-issue, again, it's a social issue, not a bread and butter issue, is because they think they've got the majority of the country on their side. You're suggesting that
you're mistaken. It is a bread and butter issue to them. This is a major liberal mistake. If you're a conservative and your whole worldview is structured around family values, where the strict father family, in which you have, a moral authority who must be male, who must dominate a mother and children, and who has to protect the family and support the family and teach his kids right from wrong and dish out tough punishment and so on. If you have that as the basis of your politics, then the very idea of same-sex marriage does not fit the basis of your whole moral worldview and your politics. You know, the strict father family cannot be run by a father who is gay, or a mother who is lesbian. I mean, it just doesn't work in that whole worldview. So when they've chosen that issue, for on their side, it's not just an issue that is social and not economic. It's an issue that transcends everything, because their economic policy also follows from a strict father model of the family mapped onto politics. Mm-hmm. For them, it's really deep and everything. What happens for progressives is that a nurturing parent family, one that's based on empathy and responsibility and care, that then projects onto a politics of empathy, responsibility, and care, that kind of family could be, you know, since it's run equally by both parents, could be gay or not. It doesn't matter there. And liberals think that politics is just about economics or social values, but they don't see, as the conservatives do, that the economic and social values both come from the same place, from the family values.
But, George, how do you then craft an argument to counter the conservatives? First of all, I've seen the footage of the people getting married up at San Francisco, and you can see the joy on their faces. So I don't know what the hell people are... I mean, what's wrong with people loving each other? I mean, there's not enough love out there. There's a whole bunch of kids that aren't loved and are abandoned. The heterosexuals don't have much of a case because 60% of marriages end in divorce in any case. And furthermore, the last census that was done indicates that only 25% of Americans live in the traditional Aussie and Harriet family. There's a lot of atavistic illusion here.
That's right. And there is a way to break it. Marriage is the realization of love. That is, it's a lifelong commitment based on love. It's a public recognition of love, and it has nothing, very little to do with just civil unions. A lot of Democrats will come out and say, well, it's just a matter of economics, and we could have civil unions for that. Let's have civil unions governed by the state and marriage governed by the church or something like this. It doesn't work. I mean, you can see, you know, Shakespeare did not write, let us not unto the civil union of two minds admit impediments. He wrote marriage of two minds. The reason for that is that civil unions are about material state things, which are important. They're not that they're not important. They're extremely important. But marriage is about the hopes and dreams that people have from the time they're little kids. They're about they're about families and how families come together. They're about the deepest of commitments. This is not just about legal rights. It's not just about monetary rights and equality, economic equality. You know, it's about that and very much more. It's about the realization of love. This is an issue of human dignity, and human dignity is sacred. They are talking about the sanctity of marriage, and so should we. The sanctity of marriage for everybody is a right. It's not just a right, and it's the deepest of human rights. What's important here is that human dignity be recognized as the basis of allowing everybody the freedom to marry. The term freedom to marry is a very important one, because look at what the opposite is. Would you want the state, the government, to tell you who to marry? Any conservative comes up to you and says they're against gay marriage should be asked that question. Should the government tell you who you can and can't marry? Polls should come out there and not say, should we allow them, gays and lesbians, to marry? Rather, they should say, should the government be allowed to tell you who you can and can't marry? It's a different question. Hmm. How you frame the question is all important.
Well, George, I thank you very much for joining us. Also, you told me the other day that you've got a book coming out, too. So,
well, the old one has just come out in a new edition. That's Moral Politics. A lot of this material is in Moral Politics, but there'll be a new one being written now and finished soon.
Well, good. I thank you again for joining us and pointing out the importance of language and framing debates so that the right doesn't always usurp the high ground through their better use of language and framing issues and creating think tanks and all the rest of it. Again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for calling in.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with George Lakoff, a linguist at Berkeley. He made an interesting presentation a couple of weeks ago where he analyzed what motivates the conservative movement and why blue-collar people vote Republican against their interests. I'm joined by Michael Mann, the author of Incoherent Empire, and Michael's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles. And his major works include the prize-winning series The Sources of Social Power and The Rise of Classes and Nation-States. And he's presently working on a third volume, Globalizations, which covers the most recent period of world history. Michael, I was talking with Chalmers Johnson, and I made the sort of offhand remark that Americans aren't good at empire, and that's a good thing. So let's begin there. Do you think that, I mean, I know it's somewhat flippant, but if you assume that the British were good at empire, which, you know, I grew up where the sun never sat on the British Empire, there were all these parts of the world that were pink, you know,
that's right.
Commonwealth, and we're always told how virtuous the constitutional democracy and all this stuff and what the white man's burden and all this stuff. But so where does America compare in terms of empires?
Well, I think that America was very good at indirect empire, what I call indirect empire, from 1945 onwards, where you can exercise strong control over countries because you have a kind of client regime and you intervene if necessary to help that kind of regime. And that's really how
Now, is that what happened in the Cold War, the surrogates grew up?
And this corresponds to what was the earlier stage of previous empires, where the British would go in and rule through some local ruler and then gradually extend the power over that ruler.
Uh-huh.
But what we've had since the Bush administration took control is an attempt at a kind of direct empire of, if you threaten states, it doesn't work, they don't comply, you invade them, occupy them, restructure them, and then perhaps leave. So it's a kind of temporary uh-huh. territorial empire.
Is the cart before the horse or the horse before the cart here in terms of militarism, in terms of bases? Because Chalmers Johnson was suggesting that we'd already have had this empire of bases out there. And my feeling is that the real issue is, because none of this was ever discussed, even in Foreign Policy magazine, nobody's ever talked about the American Empire and quantified it. It seems to me to be more connected with who got their fist into the treasury. And throughout the Cold War, the military-industrial complex had a good thing going with the Soviets. There was no end in sight for how much you had to spend on deterrence. Because it was there was no definition for national security. But in the post-Cold War world, where we have subnational and transnational threats, we've never had this debate, and it seems to me that they've just shifted from a Cold War focus now to the war on terrorism, and then, you know, Afghanistan was such a paltry country and a pathetic little exercise. I think that to some extent we had to go into Iraq, because it was at least a real country and a real war. But I know I'm sort of rambling here, but the core of it is this just a continuum of the raid on the treasury?
No, I don't think it is just that. I think that now there's been a significant escalation in terms of the attempt to control foreign countries directly. And I think the motivations involved are very mixed, and obviously there is a military-industrial complex involved there, but I don't think it's the only motivation by any means. What my book says is this new form of imperialism isn't going to work, and this is what Americans aren't good at. Not because Americans in particular aren't good at it, but this is no longer the age of empires. This is the age of nation states. And if you go in and try and invade other countries without any local political allies on the ground, which we always had in the Cold War, we have the Kurds in the north of Iraq, but that's all, then it's a recipe for disaster. And so my book predicted before it happened disaster in Iraq and the continuing mess in Afghanistan, and it also predicted that the war against terrorism conducted in this way would produce more terrorists and be self-defeating.
But do we have in parallel here two kinds of empire, the military political empire that you talk about in Incoherent Empire, and this globalization, which seems to me to be a kind of a parallel force? Because when you're saying that the rest of the world doesn't want to become client states, it also seems to me that's where the core of the resistance to globalization is, that each country has a social contract with its people. Mm-hmm. The purpose of globalization mm-hmm. is to break that contract and to force people to make crops that they don't necessarily want to grow, that fit into some great global pattern of free trade, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that the smaller countries like the Scandinavians and others have maintained a higher standard of living, whereas everybody that's gone global, it's been a race to the bottom.
I think that as far as economic globalization is concerned, there is a tendency to exaggerate American powers here as well, and that what we are is a kind of backseat driver of the world. And as you point out, the governments of the world are responsible to their own electorates or their own generals or whoever it is. Right. And so the U.S., there's a limit to how far the U.S. can push them around. And I think it's very easy to overestimate American powers. Globalization, there's no point in being anti-globalization because it's happening. The question is, what kind of globalization? And there are now signs, and have been for the last couple of years, of increasing resistance to the American style of globalization. And actually, it's not just the U.S. It's the other northern countries as well that tend to hide behind the U.S. and blame it all on the U.S. It is the rich countries against the others.
So is there a place where the haves and have-nots can meet in some kind of dignity or some decent transaction, or is it just a sort of Darwinistic kind of world out there?
Well, no, it isn't just a Darwinistic world, because there is a common interest as well. It's actually to our benefit if they develop. And so what happened in Cancun is, I believe, the start of something much bigger in terms of the development of more proper bargaining in terms of how we have to give up things if they give up things. And it's not simply free trade for everybody else except us.
Let me read a section from your book here, Michael Mann, from Incoherent Empire. Given the senseless occupation of Iraq, American soldiers there will now bear the brunt of the attack. And when did you write this?
I wrote that in about March of last year.
So before the war?
Before the war, yeah.
Where some people knew that it was going to be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat, but mm-hmm. nobody apparently in the White House. Given the senseless occupation of Iraq, American soldiers there will now bear the brunt of the attack. Given the senseless strategy of Bush's war on terrorism, I await the first Hamas or Hezbollah attacks on Americans abroad for 20 years. The U.S. must remember the first law of holes. If you're in a hole, stop digging. When you're in a hole caused by killing Muslims, stop killing Muslims.
Right.
Interesting enough, Michael, the White House just sent me their a transcript of the letter from al-Zarqawi, the courier. Mm-hmm. Well, courier was intercepted from al-Qaeda to Iraq. And what an irony. Here's a president who lied to us, who said that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, when they're patently false.
Right.
But now there is.
Now there is.
Yeah, yes. They're in Iraq.
That's right, and our generals, our colonels and generals keep on saying there are these suicide bombers there who are Islamists, and there weren't before.
Right.
And the other feature is the last bombings that have been attributed to some affiliate of al-Qaeda. Half the bombers who've been named, that is alleged to be bombers, are under 25, and some of them were in university until they were 21, 22. And these are brand-new recruits. These are young men alienated by our policy, our support for Israel, our killing of 10,000 Afghans, 15,000 Iraqis, internment of young immigrants to this country, the Guantanamo Bay. Every one of these things gets reported daily across the Muslim world, across the Middle East by Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and plenty of Arab newspapers. So nothing is hidden now. We don't control the weapons of mass communication the way that the British or the French or the Romans did in earlier times. In many ways, the balance of power, despite our immense military apparatus, the balance of power has shifted away from the most powerful countries. And that's why the U.S. cannot do empire.
Well, that's why we have this paradox at the zenith of American power, with Pax Americana, with nothing in sight that can challenge the United States in military terms. We're losing our moral political, economic credibility.
Yes, and our soldiers are getting killed in Iraq. And though we've already begun the retreat, we've retreated into a smaller number of larger bases, leaving the Iraqi policemen to take the brunt of it. We were taking losses until we did this, and we still are taking some. So it is a kind of, you can't call it defeat, but it's sapping us, definitely. There's no
prospect. It's death by a thousand cuts.
That's
now,
right.
Why is it then that there isn't a debate about this, the incredible lack of logic in what we're doing here? If there is a war on terror, and if there's a justification for it, obviously, you can't fight terrorism with weapons alone. In fact, terrorism is a tactic. It's not an entity of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that there isn't any discussion about the real strength of this country? You're saying that we don't control the weapons of mass communication, and I know they're trying to send rock and roll into the Arab world, spiced with friendly news. Why isn't it that we can't reinvent our foreign policy, put the Peace Corps at the tip of the spear? Because if you look at what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, the real problems are they can't provide services. They can't provide water and food and sanitary sanitation.
This is much
easier, you would think, than fighting wars.
Indeed, and a lot cheaper.
Right.
An enormously amount cheaper it would be to greatly increase the foreign aid program, the Peace Corps, and all of these things. Of course, that does seem rather utopian. On the other hand...
But it's more practical than what they're
that's
doing.
That's right. It is more practical.
It may be utopian, but...
It is definitely more practical, yes.
Is there a constituency anywhere that's even talking about this? Because I know that we talked about the military-industrial complex. I don't know that there's a Peace Corps lobby out there.
No, I don't think there at present there is a big lobby. But change has to be, you know, has to start in small ways. And if we can, well, if we can get a Democrat into the White House, that's perhaps the regime change comes up.
There's a sense that we need regime change, but how do you bring it back? Do you think that? You know, that as we're saying with Ron Suskin, who did the book on with the Treasury Secretary, was saying that this is the most ideological White House that we've ever had. And ideology doesn't necessarily connect with the real world and that reality bites. So do you have a sense that it's going to bite? And I mean, I don't see Kerry or any of those guys, say, coming up with a better mousetrap. I mean... This is what's so disgusting about what Bush has done. He's put this country into an impossible situation. So it's somebody's got to bail him out. But, you know, so is anybody going to come up with a better... Because the neocons, one of the reasons they got away with their wacky notions is that there was no countervailing vision out there.
Right.
And I just was offering up a sketchy one with the idea of putting changing our entire focus of foreign policy towards... AID and the Peace Corps.
Yes. Well, I think that it should be perfectly possible to develop a more coherent and progressive foreign policy, which is indeed also in our economic interest. There is a problem at the moment in terms of foreign policy, in that during the war, this incredible wartime self-censorship came down. And Democratic politicians were unwilling to put their head over the parapet. And it appears we're going to get a primary, a winner from the Democrats who is going to be compromised by having supported the war. And that is a major problem.
Well, he's arguing that he's actually, it gives him permission to go against it.
Yes, but what's he going to say? He's going to say they lied to us.
Well, that's what he did,
to you and me as well, but we weren't taken in by it because we knew how... At odds it was with the facts, and in my case, I knew it wasn't going to work.
It's not good on your presidential resume to say you got suckered by George W. Bush.
That's right.
You know, but still, it does seem that the natives are restless. There's more and more people showed up at the Democratic primaries in history.
Yes.
You know, this...
But also what's going on inside the administration is that actually more and more of them realize that they have made a mistake. This is why the troops are being pulled back.
Right.
This is why the privatization plan in Iraq has been abandoned. And it's why the neocons are actually now having less influence. It's not being admitted publicly, and that's the problem. The problem is whether this disastrous foreign policy, one which is producing more terrorists and producing more deaths among American soldiers and billions of dollars, whether all of these things are recognized by November or whether it's going to be afterwards. And this war leader should be destroyed by his inability over the war.
Interesting enough, a lot of Republicans are starting to feel squeamish about this crowd.
Yes.
Because they recognize what a disaster they've been fiscally
and
how they really don't stand for capitalism. They stand for crony capitalism.
Right. Well, in fact, my book is not a book of high moral denunciation of this regime, but of how its policies will fail and on realist grounds, how it's counterproductive for the United States and will bring down our power.
Now, why is it then that Tony Blair, the one bit of adult supervision that apparently they have around there, and Blair apparently was complaining that every time he meets privately with Bush, Cheney's there, uninvited, which ties into what Ron Suskin was saying earlier, that he's kind of the Eminence Grey, that is sort of the puppeteer for our extremely limited president. What's motivating him?
Well, I think that he was taken in by the apparent American military might. That is, the ability that the Americans could do it, and therefore it was better to be with them than against them. And in this way, Britain could play the traditional mediating role between the U.S. and Europe. He's been really surprised by the aftermath. Luckily for the British, their troops, our troops, I have both citizenships, so I say we, they interchangeably.
Yeah, well, I suppose I can say we because the Australians went in with the...
But what the British are doing in Basra, around Basra, is what the British Empire did for centuries. They go into each village and they say, who's the big man here? And they get him and they say, well, we'll support you if you support us. It's got nothing to do with democracy, but that's how empires are ruled. But they have a slightly easier task in the south, so that Blair is not under as much pressure because, though the public, it was anti-war, they haven't got British casualties of any substance to reckon with.
And they presumably don't have the neocons, this cadre of ideologues.
That's right.
That have captured American foreign policy.
That's right.
Doug Feith, who is Deputy Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. and Richard Perles, and he wrote this document for the Likud when they were both working for Netanyahu.
That's right.
It's become the kind of blueprint for this insanity. Yeah. It's interesting, that Doug Feith apparently vetoes everybody that is hired by he has veto power, and everybody that's hired by the CPA, the Provisional Authority in Iraq, mm-hmm. and any American Arabist is automatically disqualified on the basis that anybody that speaks Arabic is suspect and is not sufficiently pro-Likud.
Right.
I mean, what a wacky way to run a railroad. I mean, you're in an Arabic-speaking country and you can't use your institutional knowledge. It's not unlike the lack of institutional knowledge that was able to be...
We have the Arab-speaking émigrés. That's enough.
Oh, yeah, got the Lebanese, right.
But it is a danger to underestimate our opponents. And that's what the Bush administration constantly does in regard to Iraq and terrorists and the like, by calling them evil and and dead-enders and no-hopers. It's quite unable to appreciate the kind of powers that they have. And we mustn't underestimate the neocons either. They have some forms of knowledge. Right. They have knowledge about oil and they have knowledge about military affairs, at least of offense.
Right.
But they and they rely heavily on supposedly on Bernard Lewis, the one Arabist who's been supporting them, and right, one American Arabist who's been supporting them.
You know, I tried to get him on my program. Uh-huh. I called him up and said, would you mind being on this program? And he said, well, I don't know you. And I said, well, I guarantee I can put a sentence together and maybe we'll have an interesting talk. And he said, well, I don't think so. And I said, well, I saw you on Charlie Rose. He said, yes, but Charlie Rose is a known quantity, and you're not. So I wasn't exactly thrilled with Bernard. I thank you for joining us. Again, Michael Mann's book, Incoherent Empire. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to be joined by Mark Green, the author of The Book on Bush, How George W. Misleads America, and... Mark Green ran against Bloomberg in the recent race for the mayor of New York City, and I guess he didn't have $60 million of his own money to buy a mayoral seat. I always wondered why Bloomberg felt it was worth $60 million to become mayor of New York, but perhaps we should do an interview with him and find out. I don't know whether... Mark Green, are you there?
$73 million.
$73 million. Now, here I am rambling away. I didn't realize you were on the phone.
Who's counting? How are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So I take it you didn't have $73 million to blow.
No, I didn't. He wanted to be mayor. He's allowed.
Right.
He spent as much money in one city, in current dollars, Ian, uh-huh. as Lyndon Johnson spent in 50 states getting elected president. So it was a phenomenon, and unfortunately, we may see more of extremely wealthy men using their own private dollars to buy public office.
Well, that's, normally you get a job and you get a salary from the job. This is a new twist where you spend millions to hire yourself.
Well, George W. Bush, is a man of means. He's not a multi-billionaire like Michael Bloomberg, but he is spending $150 million of largely special interest money. He cuts taxes on average $90,000 for every person earning over $1 million a year. So then, when the White House and he call someone getting that much money and ask for a contribution of $2,000 or $4,000, guess what? To them, it's like an investment, and he gets it. And so he's raising a phenomenal amount of money from the the wealthiest Americans who he serves, as we argue in our book.
Well, clearly, it seems that Washington now, under the Republicans, represents capital and not people. So how come the Democrats can't get that message out that they're the party of the people? I mean...
Well, they can. First of all, you know, in the last year, there have been 9, 10 people running for president on the Democratic side. There was no one voice, mm-hmm. of course, to equal the one Republican voice, much less the president's voice behind the bully pulpit of the presidency. Now, we're about the point where, let's say, John Kerry is the Democratic nominee, George W. Bush, of course, the Republican nominee and president, and early polls show that Kerry actually is ahead because he argues that Bush's, and we argue this in the book on Bush, he uses populist language, but to cover the fact that it's a plutocratic government shifting trillions of dollars through the tax code from low-income, middle-income people to the wealthiest Americans, shifting a inherited $5 trillion surplus to a $4 trillion deficit in 3 years. It's not that easy.
Well, and there's not a lot to show for it. This is the part that I have
Baghdad.
Well, yeah, but I challenge you to go down, have a meal downtown Baghdad without a flak jacket.
I will not take you up on that challenge.
I mean, it seems so clear that let me ask you this, Mark Green. Do you believe that Bush is a conservative or a radical? Because there's Grover Norquist, this strange fellow in Washington that seems to have a lot of influence. He believes that the purpose of the Republican Revolution is to strangle the government, shrink the government down to a size that it can be strangled in a bathtub. So, is this what the subtext of all this is? That they're going to wreck Social Security and Medicare so that you'll be at the mercy of HMOs and drug companies for your health, you'll be at the mercy of Wall Street for your pensions, and you'll be having to rely on the churches for faith-based charity instead of welfare.
You know, if I hadn't, you should have written the book on Bush, Ian. What we argue is the following. Other presidents have misspoken, sometimes lied. But the Niagara of dissembling coming out of the White House is so stunning. To say there's not global warming as the Arctic glaciers melt by 60%, to say we'll see cheering crowds and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course, we've seen neither. To say it's a jobs program, and then they lose jobs for the first time in 60 years in a government. So the question is, how can they make so many misstatements? The answer is, instead of weighing facts, which lead to conclusions, as, you know, a conservative or liberal president from Nixon to Kennedy did, President Bush seems to arrive at conclusions and then search for quote-unquote facts to sustain his largely radical conclusions. Forgive me, but it's radical to say that there's not global warming, to have a unilateral preemptive war, to shift funds from the middle class to the already wealthy. And the reason is he's indebted to his political base of the religious right, second, big business, largely energy in Texas, and third, neoconservative intellectuals, which misled him and us into this war. Because he puts a premium on servicing his base, he's really hurting America economically and militarily.
Well, tell me, Marguerite, do you, and I know that are you working for Kerry, right, in New York?
Well, I'm a supporter. I'm his co-chair in New York State.
Well, tell me about, do you think that Kerry can ever smoke this guy out? I know the debates are going to be fairly tightly scripted and orchestrated, and frankly, it's hardly adequate. And we started out earlier with Ron Suskind, who kind of pried loose the covers with the book from the former Treasury Secretary,
right,
about the dysfunctional nature of this is a White House driven by ideologues. And one would hope. And this is the question I would wish somebody could ask Bush, and obviously Kerry would be the perfect guy to do it. Is he a We know he's born again, and he's said that on any number of occasions. And obviously, if you were a coke fiend and a drunk, and the Lord Jesus stepped into your life, and lo and behold, you became president of the United States, that's nobody's going to argue with the success of that, right? But I want to know whether this man believes all of this stuff that's on Christian television. You watch Christian television, the 700 Club, etc. It's all about Armageddon. It's all about the end of the world. And they make no bones about the fact that George Bush, they consider George Bush the leader of their movement. Now, it's a fundamental conflict of interest to have your finger on the nuclear button and to believe that the world is going to end, and that, in fact, it's your Christian duty to accelerate that process so that we can have the rapture and all the good Southern Baptists will rise up in the heaven, and the rest of us will be boiling in hell. So
you've asked a very difficult question. Almost all presidents are believing people. Actually, Washington was something of a deist, but they all, you know, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton would always emerge from church on Sundays, Bible in hand, and the public would see that. John Kennedy, of course, confronted this primarily when people thought, aha, first Catholic who could actually win the presidency, is he going to be controlled by his religion? And he had a famous public speech to the Houston ministers in 1960 saying, look, I'm a proud Catholic, but I don't take orders from anyone in my secular job, not my church. The public accepted that. So here's George W. Bush, a very believing man who's constantly using religious language in speeches. And so far, that's okay. Most of the Americans like that. But the question is, if he gets to, let's say, a Cuban missile crisis, would he think through in a secular way what's in the interest of the country? Or would he say, damn them? Moral clarity means that so God is on our side, and our God is bigger than their God. By the way, that's an exact quote, not from just someone on the 700 Club, for which Bush is not responsible, but a prominent Army general was quoted as saying that and was never reprimanded. And so you'll have to ask Bush. I mean, I've studied him with Eric Altman for our book on Bush. But the issue is, does religion inform his values, which is normal, but does it control his policies, which is abnormal?
It seems to me that the natives are restless. If you look at the numbers on people who came out to the primaries in New Hampshire, Iowa, and in particular Washington State, there's an indication that maybe there is regime change in the wind.
Bush ran saying he was a uniter,
not a divider.
He was right. Right. He's united Democrats and many independents to stand up and say credibility gap is really a reality gap, and enough already. The number of people marching last February 15th against the war was phenomenal in this country and around the world. The number of people voting in primaries is a tickler, a bellwether of the intensity against him. Conservatives were intensely against Clinton in 2000 and took it out on Al Gore. The opposite, Ian and I agree, is now true. And these numbers are indicating that, not to mention, Kerry is substantially ahead of Bush in polls today. That will change.
Not if you watch Fox News.
Well, I don't.
I know, but I tell you, it's amazing.
No, well, Fox is Fox.
Right.
And everyone understands that fair and balanced is meant to be ironic, as Al Franken pointed out in his book on lying liars. And so I think his credibility gap leading to radical policies has created a backlash. Today's New York Times has an interesting article about Republicans who are considering crossing over. And they interview some of them who 6 months ago were dyed-in-the-wool Bush fans, and even before they've read the book on Bush, are saying, what is this? Our soldiers have targets on their back. They're dying for no serious purpose in Iraq because we're creating more terrorists there than we found. The economy is unusually weak historically. Why are we sticking with this guy? One last point, Ian. You asked whether Kerry could expose Bush in a debate.
Uh-huh.
Bush is like a talking points president. He'll say four things. Saddam is dangerous. Dangerous is Saddam. No matter how much you show that all the arguments for going into this war have melted, he just sticks to a few talking points. John Kerry was such a brilliant debater at Yale as a student that undergraduates prayed for him to graduate because they could never win the debating crown while he was there. This doesn't mean he should be president, but it means that in a debate, not just a two-minute interview of George W. Bush, but an actual debate, it's possible, if the format is right, that Kerry could expose him. Remember that Eisenhower, by this time in his first term, had 80 press conferences. George W. Bush, the father Bush, 70. Lyndon Johnson, 60. George W. Bush, 11. He is so underexposed to the public in terms of being cross-examined, because his handlers are worried, that the debates could approach the importance of the very first Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960.
Well, I'm frankly shocked that the public don't demand more. I mean, he is their leader, and they should know how he thinks, what he thinks, who he is. It goes against the very essence of democracy to be this secretive.
I think that's why this stable of extraordinary books on Bush have now done so well. Ron Susskind's book, of course, Michael Moore's book, Al Franken's book, Joe Connison's book, David Corn's book.
And your book's on the New York Times bestseller.
I'm sorry?
Your book is on the New York Times bestseller now.
Next week, we were told that the book on Bush will be on the Times bestseller list. Also, of course, Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, which you mentioned. These 8 to 10 books are all different. They're all on Bush. And they complement each other not only as a premium for your wonderful station, but because the mainstream media has fallen down on exposing Bush. Perhaps they're pulling their punches post 9/11 because they don't want to seem unpatriotic. Well, individual authors have now told the true story about Bush, and it's breaking out into the mainstream and is reflected now in national polls, and we'll know November 2nd.
Mark Green, I thank you very much for joining us and for your book, the book on Bush, How George W. Misleads America. Again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. You're speaking there with Mark Green, who's the author of the book on Bush, How George W. Misleads America. I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. This program can be heard on ianmasters.org, on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.